Start by asking a question. How many people here, you can raise your hands, have had the experience of introducing someone important to you to your parents? Yeah? Probably most of us, right? Maybe it's a significant other, maybe a potential spouse, maybe a friend or a coworker. But there's a little bit of nervousness, right? Somebody that you know that's close to you, and you have to introduce them to your parents, and there's a question of, how will your parents respond? Will they like this person? How will this person respond? What if they can't stand each other? It's tricky. It's stressful. And yet at the same time, it's a bit of a privilege to bring two people that have some role in your life together. And by doing that, you're starting something. You're beginning a relationship. And if all things go well, if the relationship progresses eventually, then that relationship has a life of its own. And it might happen even without your involvement. That's how you know that things have gone well. This morning is the second week of what will be a 10-month journey through the Gospel of John that we're calling Signs of Life around here. We're really excited as a church to dive into this gospel, to really explore the great depth and power that John shows of Jesus through his words. We've identified several themes that John uses to guide us through, and we're kind of using those to map our way through the gospel. This week is the second week of looking at this theme of the Word, or in Greek, logos. Last week we talked about logos, and I suggested that it was this cosmic, out there idea. Logos referred to that thing that's out there that people are aware of, that spiritual entity that's there, and yet people sometimes struggle to give a name to. I called it the other. And what we've seen the author of this gospel do is take that idea and develop it. Last week we saw how he made it personal, how he said that the Logos was God, how the Logos took part in creation, the Logos was the source of life, and finally that the Logos was here, that the light is shining today. Today we're looking at the second part of what's usually referred to as the prologue of John. We'll look at John 1, 6 to 18. And as I've been studying this, this is just one of the most beautiful, poetic, amazing passages of Scripture. And I've been overcome with the feeling that almost to say anything about this is to make it worse. So I apologize in advance for taking away from the text, if that's what I end up doing. Because this is really powerful stuff. What we're going to find in this passage, in the second half of the prologue, is the gospel author continuing this development of who the Logos is. And what we'll see him doing is essentially doing the same thing that most of you have done when you're introducing someone to your parents. The concern for this gospel author is to introduce two parties, to begin a relationship, to start things going. But it isn't just any introduction that he's doing. And although John's book is about Jesus, his ultimate concern is not to introduce Jesus. It's someone else. In fact, this section has a chain of three individuals that make sort of a progressive introduction. And so first we start off by hearing about John the Baptist, a man who comes with the purpose to introduce the Logos to the world. But then as we get to the Logos, as we get to Jesus, we realize that Jesus himself isn't all about Jesus. That Jesus has a purpose too, and that is to introduce the world to God the Father. And so in this passage, we get this chain of John the Baptist introducing Jesus, the Logos, who in turn introduces God the Father. Now, one of the great things about the way that John writes is he writes in a spiral. So he introduces ideas and he brings them back and he comes back to them, and it's this incredible method of surrounding us with the ideas as we read it. Unfortunately, John is a better author than I am a preacher, so we're going to straighten out that spiral. We're going to pull it straight, and what I'll do is I'll read the whole passage. I'm going to read from verses 6 to 18. And then we're going to take those three characters one by one, John the Baptist, and then Jesus, and then God the Father. Kind of pull that spring straight and follow those characters and see how John builds this progressive introduction from one to the other. So So here's John 1, 6 through 18. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. He came as a witness to bear witness about the light that all might believe through him. He was not the light, but came to bear witness about the light. The true light, which gives light to everyone, was coming into the world. He was in the world, and the world was made through him, yet the world did not know him. He came to his own, and his own people did not receive him. But to all who did receive him, who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And we have seen his glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. John bore witness about him and cried out, "This was he of whom I said, he who comes after me ranks before me, because he was before me. For from his fullness we have all received grace upon grace. For the law was given through Moses, grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. No one has ever seen God, the only God, who is at the Father's side. He has made him known." And so John, the author, begins with John the Baptist, two different Johns, and he introduces us to the Logos, the light, who in turn ends up introducing us to that which has never been known, God himself, who Jesus uniquely reveals. John the Baptist to Jesus, to God the Father. So let's see then how John the author moves from one individual to the other and how it climaxes in this grand conclusion of knowing God himself. Last week we learned about the Logos. And one of the things we saw about the Logos is that through the Logos, all things came to be. I had a little magic trick that I used to demonstrate the glory of that. And if you're still wondering how it was done, you could check out the video and slow motion it and see if maybe you could figure out my secrets. But when this section begins, we immediately get a contrast from the Logos, because the language that's used here literally reads, "There came to be a man whose name was John." And so we're meant to notice the difference that through the Logos, all things came to be. The Logos caused things to come to be, but this man, John the Baptist, he was a recipient of coming to be. He himself came to be. And the author is trying to make it very clear that John the Baptist is not the Christ. He repeats that John the Baptist came as a witness to the light. He wasn't the light, but he came to speak of the light. And so the author is emphasizing that these are different, fundamentally different characters. Next week, we'll look a little bit more about why that's such an important distinction to make. For this week, our purpose is, we want to realize that in this passage, we're not just told who John wasn't, but we are also told who he was. And the language that's used here is interesting. The gospel author says that John came as a witness. Now, there is a Greek word that is usually used to refer to an individual who sees something, who can then describe what he has seen. That's what we typically think of as witness. That's not the word that's used here. The word used here is the word that's usually translated testimony, which would refer to the content that a witness speaks. So usually we would say that the witness is the individual and the testimony is what the witness says. What's unique about the way it's phrased here, though, is that John the Baptist is called the testimony. It's as if the author is saying that John's whole life, his whole being, his whole identity is the testimony of who Jesus is. It's not just the words he speaks, but it's everything about him builds together to reveal who Jesus is. And that's what's great about John the Baptist. He is this singular character in Scripture that has one simple goal for his entire life. His whole purpose is to introduce Jesus so that people might believe in him, so that they might have life. Let's say that you work for a certain company, and let's say that your boss has made it clear that she has some openings for new positions, and you have a friend that has skills that qualify him for that position. So you think, great, I know what to do. You introduce your friend to your boss, right? Now, when you do that with one simple purpose in mind. You don't probably hope that your boss and your friend will start dating and get married and have a wonderful life. You don't probably hope that they'll go on vacation together to the wine country. There's a lot of things you don't hope, but there's one thing you want to happen. You want your friend to get a job, right? That's the story of John the Baptist. He introduces the world to the Logos for one simple purpose, and his whole life is wrapped around that, that people might believe in Jesus. You might ask, well, why does Jesus even need to be introduced? I mean, if he is the Logos, if he created everything, why does he need an introduction? Why doesn't he just show up? Well, let me suggest a couple answers. First of all, it's not Jesus that needs the introduction. It's us. So when you introduce your friend to your boss, you're not doing so for the sake of your boss. She probably has dozens of resumes on her desk, plenty of candidates. You're concerned about your friend getting a job. That's what John the Baptist is concerned for. It's not that Jesus needs followers. It's that we need life. And so John introduces the world, us, to the source of life so that we might believe. But even more importantly, in this culture, witnesses were extremely important. The Old Testament has all these specifications and details about what kinds of witnesses are acceptable in certain situations, how many witnesses you need in certain cases to know that something indeed happened. And it's interesting to me that even in our culture, the same is true. Even with video and cameras and DNA and fingerprints and all sorts of tests and scientific studies, when it comes right down to it, a lot of court cases turn on a witness, on someone who can say, I saw this happen. Now, I've seen crime TV, so I know this is true. A witness is key to knowing the truth. And so John the Baptist comes then as a witness to reveal the truth about Jesus. And later in this gospel, Jesus says to his followers that you too will be witnesses to what you have seen. And so as we see John the Baptist playing this role as a witness, one of our responses is to say, that's our role too. Just as he is a witness, so ought we to be witnesses. We can be a witness. Now, the language I'm using is intentional here. Notice that I'm not telling you necessarily to do something in particular. I'm suggesting that we think about our identity in a certain way, that we are witnesses. John came as a witness. His life, everything about him, all of his experiences gave testimony to the truth of who Jesus was and is. That's what's true of us as well. Now, certainly John the Baptist's identity meant that he did certain things, and certainly if we are witnesses, then we will do certain things in line with that, but I can't tell you what those things are. I don't know what actions your identity as a witness will necessarily relate in. I'm not telling you specifically to witness in the sense that it's sometimes used in Christian language. And when people say you ought to witness, they mean you ought to verbally explain the fact that Jesus died for the sins of the world. Now, that's probably part of being a witness at times, but being a witness, considering your life as wrapped up in revealing who Jesus is so much more than that. It consumes everything. all of our thoughts, all of our interactions, all of who we are. But here's the cool thing. Our text says that John the Baptist came as a witness to the light. But what is light? Light itself isn't really anything. Light reveals something else. And so as we think about what we ought to be a witness of, we realize that we are witnesses of light. So John the Baptist came as a witness to the light. Now let's think about what is this light that John the Baptist and we are witnesses of. When we hear about the light, the first thing we hear is that it was coming into the world. The true light was coming into the world. The gospel author John is uniquely concerned with the idea of the world. This is the Greek word cosmos, and the word refers to not the world as a planet, but the world as the community of people that inhabit that planet. The world is people. The world is us. And John uses this word differently than the Apostle Paul uses it. There's nothing negative to the way John uses it. It's not the world in its sinful desires or the world in its passions. This is simply the world, the created people, the mass of humanity. John uses this word 78 times in his gospel, another 23 times in the small book of 1 John. When you combine those, that's more than half of the times this word is used in the whole New Testament. So John has this particular concern for the world. It's almost as if everything that he writes is the story of the Logos meeting the world, this beautiful introduction. And yet, when we read it here, it's not exactly a romantic comedy. John describes, he was in the world, and the world was made through him, yet the world did not know him. There's a TV show that's popular right now called Undercover Boss. Has anybody seen this show? Yeah? So the premise is that there's a high-ranking person in a company, maybe the CEO or an executive, who goes in disguise and takes on an entry-level job working kind of down on the floor or whatever it might be, along people who presumably don't recognize that they are now working next to the person who might own the company. And so this leads to all kinds of observations about what life is really like at the company and what people really think of the boss and all sorts of stuff like this. But there's a tension there, that the boss is there and yet unrecognized. And for the show, the tension is interesting and fun to watch. It's the same tension that John describes here. The Logos, the creator of the world, the source of life, has come into the world, and yet the world did not know him. But here the tension is tragic. Here you want to ask, how could that be? And yet it gets worse. Because John says that not only did they not recognize him, when he came to his own people, they didn't receive him. They rejected him. His own people rejected him. Have you experienced that? Coming to some group of people or some person that you ought to have been included in, that you ought to be accepted by, and yet you're turned away, you're excluded. It's painful, right? It's disorienting. It makes you ask questions about yourself and about them and about the nature of things. And if you're like me, your first reaction is just to want to run away, to say, forget those people, I'll find some other people. But that's not what Jesus does at all. In fact, he knew that he was going to be rejected, and yet he went to great lengths in order to come into the world so that he could be rejected. The phrase that's used that captures that is this beautiful phrase, the Word became flesh. And this is something that we just can't get our minds around. The Logos, the Creator, condescending himself, stooping down, taking on the nature of his creation. We would expect that the Logos would come in power. We would expect that the Logos would reveal himself with glory and might, come riding on the clouds, and yet this is not what happens at all. The Logos takes on that which we desperately want to take off. We desperately want to shed this mortality that is weak and broken and sick and dying. And yet the Logos assumes it so that something might be known, so that the light might reveal something in the world. So just as John was a testimony to reveal Jesus, Jesus comes as a light entering the world, taking on flesh so that something can be known. Light comes into the world and reveals something. The image that comes to me that I like is that of opening the windows and letting the light in. When you open the windows in a room, light reveals, it warms, it creates an inviting atmosphere. So if we have a role to play in Jesus coming into the world, in the light revealing something, perhaps our role is that of opening the windows. Open the windows. We have an impressive morning routine in my house. A lot of you know we have 5 kids, and this year our routine has gotten complicated that we have 2 different schools to get to. So we have a schedule that begins at about 6 or 6:30, and everybody knows their role in this plan. And you know at this time you're supposed to do this part of the thing so that we can get out, get to school on time. One of the roles is that of going through the bedrooms and drawing the curtains and raising the blinds. Because at night, it's dark, and we want it to stay dark because we want to sleep, and we want to sleep as long as we need to. But in the morning, we want the light to come in. And I love that moment where you go into a dark room and you draw the curtains and raise the blinds and the light illuminates the room. Now, it would take a lot of light bulbs to light up the bedrooms in our house as well as the light, the sunlight coming through a relatively small window does. It would take a lot of work to install those light bulbs and maintain those light bulbs and power those light bulbs. And yet, opening the windows is relatively easy. I think sometimes we make our role in all of this harder than it needs to be. Sometimes we think we need to be the light, we need to create the light, we need to bring truth to things. But what if all we're asked to do is open the windows, to allow Jesus to enter into the lives of us and the people we know, and allow that light to do its work? Sometimes people don't want the light to come in. Sometimes they're afraid of what they might see. Sometimes they've worked hard to prevent the light from coming into their lives. Sometimes they've just forgotten that there is light in the world. Opening the windows looks different for different people. Some people perhaps need the windows to be opened on their pain. They've worked hard to hide the suffering they're going through, and they need someone to see their pain and say, I can tell that you are going through something hard. And that truth, that light reveals something. Sometimes people need the windows to be opened on their needs. They've worked hard to be independent and self-sufficient and not need anybody else, and they need someone to talk to them and recognize, boy, you need help. Can I come alongside you? Can I walk with you in this? Sometimes people need the windows to be opened on their confusion. They're living life, they're doing the regular things, but they don't know why. They're just putting one foot in front of the other. They've lost a sense of purpose. And they need someone to say, why don't you stop and think? Life could be different. Life doesn't have to be this way. But opening windows on pain and needs and confusion is scary. There's a lot of fear of what might be seen, what might show up. And that's where our passage reaches its grand conclusion. John says that John the Baptist came to introduce us to Jesus. Jesus came so that the light might come in and reveal truth. And the question we have is, what's going to be shown when the light comes in the room? Well, I like it. And that's where we go next. John's gospel is all about Jesus, and yet Jesus is not all about Jesus. Jesus didn't come so that we can know him, Jesus came so that we can know the Father. The light came to reveal God himself to us. So what is it that gets revealed? Well, there's a lot said about God in these verses, but everything reaches its climax with two big words, grace and truth. This phrase is repeated twice. Grace is repeated again in another context. And so if Jesus is the light, if Jesus comes into the world, if he comes into the room to show us what's there is God, and what we see is that God is grace and truth. God is grace and truth. Now, I've sometimes heard these words referred to in a kind of yin-yang relationship, as if grace on one side is mercy and love and forgiveness and being nice, and truth on the other side is being demanding and strict and holding off big requirements and telling you what your life ought to look like. And what Jesus does is he combines these things, holiness and forgiveness. He combines high standards with merciful love in this great entity. Now, I think that's true. Jesus does do that. But that's not how John is using these words. He's not using truth to refer to holiness or high standards. He's using truth simply to refer to what is. And so he's saying grace and truth in a sense that these words go together. They don't at all stand in contrast to each other. And what John is saying is that truth is the nature of God, and grace is the personality of God. Truth is the nature of God, and grace is the personality of God. But what does it mean to say that truth is the nature of God? It means that God is what is true. Now, we're going to get a little philosophical here. The simplest way to say this is simply to say God is. That's it. When God revealed himself to Moses in the Old Testament, Moses said, okay, God, I'll do what you asked me to do, but how about a name? Can you give me a name so I can tell them who sent me? And God says, sure thing, no problem. Tell them I am sent you. And Moses says, huh? I was looking for something a lot easier than that. When God is asked to name himself, he says simply, I exist. I am truth. I am all there is. God is truth. He is the standard by which all things are measured. When my first child turned about 2 years old, she would ask me questions about the world, and I would do my best to answer them. And sometimes she would listen to my answer and she would say, no, that's not right. And I'd be amazed. I would think, where does this two-year-old child, where is she going to get other information besides me? It's not like she has access to Wikipedia or Google. She's not searching for information. She's just deciding that her only source of information is wrong. But this is what doesn't happen with God. God is truth. There is no other source of information. It's not just that it's inaccessible. It doesn't exist. God is all there is. He defines reality. That's why it doesn't make sense to call God unfair. That would require a standard of justice above God that he doesn't meet. But there isn't anything above God. God is all there is. Justice is God's character. God defines fairness by what he does. So for John to say that truth came through Jesus is to say that Jesus reveals the nature of God, that God simply is. And so it makes sense then that John would use the metaphor of light throughout his gospel to refer to Jesus. Jesus is the light. God is the room. The light comes into the room and it shows what is. It shows us God. So then, what do we see? What is God like? That's where we get to grace. If truth is the nature of God, then grace is the personality of God. Grace is what God is like. Now, grace is probably one of the most commonly used words in Christian circles. It's at the core of the Christian gospel. It is central to what we believe, and yet sometimes I think we kind of tweak it a little bit incorrectly. The most common definition that I've heard of grace is unmerited favor. People will say that grace is the fact that God shows goodwill toward us even though we don't deserve it. Now, let me assure you and start out by saying we don't deserve God's favor. The scriptures are clear about that. But the word that's used here, grace, the Greek word charis, doesn't actually say anything about whether or not we deserve God's favor. Grace, in its simplest translation, is simply favor. It simply says that God shows goodwill toward us. The word charis is used in Greek writings sometimes to refer to favor that's earned and sometimes to refer to favor that's unearned. So by using this word, John isn't pointing out that we don't deserve God's favor. He's simply saying that God has favor on us. Now, I think this is important because sometimes I worry that as Christians, we have a hard time saying God loves you without immediately adding, even though you're a really terrible person. Now, it's true that we are broken. Again, let me affirm that we do not deserve God's favor. But sometimes we just need to hear that God loves us. I don't deserve the favor of my wife. I've done plenty to show that. And yet every time she says, I love you, she doesn't immediately add, even though you really don't deserve it. She only says that about half the time. So, you know, she's gentle that way. So to say that God is grace is to say that his basic orientation toward us, toward people, is to want good for them. Goodwill, favor, to be on their side. Now, that's also not to say that he doesn't get angry or discipline, because grace, real favor, is compatible with discipline, with structure, even with anger. Because if you want somebody's good, when they make decisions or other people make decisions that result in evil, the good response, the right response, is anger and discipline. What we see here is that the basic orientation of God is to have favor toward us. Do you believe that? I'm always amazed that what is probably one of the most central ideas of Christianity is one of the hardest to grasp at its core for us. To really rest and trust in the fact that God wants good for us, that he looks upon us with favor, that he shows us grace. For most of us, this is a lifetime of learning this, of stumbling over this, of allowing this truth to sink into us in deeper and newer ways. But that's the end of the line here in this prologue of John's gospel. Jesus reveals God, and what he reveals about God is that he is grace. And so the last encouragement for us then is simply to come back to the core, to realize that God is grace and to experience the grace of God in our lives. Experience grace. Grace really is the key. It's the key in coming to Jesus. Because if you're hiding something, if you're living in the darkness, if you don't want the light to reveal the truth, there's no way you're going to come into the light. There's no way you're going to welcome the light into your life unless you believe that what you will find is favor, forgiveness, love, and mercy. You can't come to Jesus without trusting that you will find grace when you get there. Grace is the key to living the Christian life because it's hard. We go through struggles, we face pain and sickness and death and relational conflict and all sorts of things. We can't face that without knowing that God is on our side, without living, without standing in the grace of God. And finally, grace is the key for us being able to do what we've seen happen in this text this morning. if we are to play the role that John the Baptist played, if we are to be witnesses, if we are to open the windows, the only way we can do that is if we've experienced something for ourselves. The only way we can be a witness to who Jesus is, to who God is if we've experienced the grace of God in our life. And once we have experienced that, our lives truly become testimonies to who God is in the world. The basic truth about God is that God is, and God is grace. Introductions are important. It's not as if God needs to be introduced. It's not as if he needed John the Baptist or he needs us to be introduced to the world. And yet, God chooses to work through people, to reveal himself slowly, gently, gradually to the world that he's created. And so in the second half of John's prologue here, we've seen this progressive introduction. John the Baptist coming on the scene, revealing Jesus, the light, who in turn shines the light and shows us who God really is, and we see that God is grace. And so, in conclusion, let me summarize this prologue for us and complete the introduction that John is trying to make. Grace of God, meet the people of PBC. People of PBC, meet the grace of God. The rest is up to you.